What's your motive? Two people can give, two people can pray, two people can fast, two people can do religious deeds. You and I would never know the difference between one or the other, and yet to God, one is a source of joy, a sweet-smelling savor, and the other is smoke in his nose.
Hypocrisy is a sin that warranted some of Jesus' harshest criticism. Sadly, it's also a sin that we all struggle with at times. Perhaps there are moments in your life where you strive to make sure everything looks good on the outside, but on the inside you're full of lust or envy or pride or anxiety. Often, that kind of spiritual dishonesty can lead to guilt and inner turmoil. If that describes you, how do you change? How do you live a genuine Christian life, one without hypocrisy? Find out as John helps you experience the peace that comes from living real. That's the title of the series he begins today. John, this title, Living Real, seems to be suggesting that it's possible to live in a way that's not real. It doesn't sound like something most believers would be tempted to do.
Oh, quite on the contrary, Phil. We're all tempted to put on a show. We're all tempted to some level of hypocrisy.
There's a Pharisee inside each one of us.
Yeah, I mean, we all want people to think we're better than we really are. We all, and I think rightly so, want to cover our weaknesses and cover our failures and put on the best front we can. The real blessing of the Christian life is when the real you is real.
Hmm.
When you're not covering, you're not hiding, you're not, you know, I go back so often to 2 Corinthians 1:12 where Paul says, my conscience is clear. All these accusations coming at Paul about his life and secret sin and all of this, pride and in it for the money and all kinds of terrible things. He says, my conscience is clear that in godliness and in true sincerity, I have ministered to you. I have a clear conscience. When you can say, I have a clear conscience, that's you're living real. That's really you. When your conscience is hammering you and you're carrying on some kind of a front, but secretly you're being battered by your conscience, that's hypocrisy. I don't know how pastors in ministry can do that. I don't know how they can have some kind of secret life going on, get up in a pulpit and put on a show while their conscience has to be just hammering them. How can there be anything but guilt and shame and fear in that? So living real is getting beyond the superficial, getting beyond the hypocritical, and letting people say, this is the true you. I remember years ago, there was a popular conspiracy going around in Christian counseling that everybody had layers and layers covering some secret corruption. You remember that.
Yep.
These guys would come along and say, I want to teach you to peel back the layers to find the corruption. And so one of them said to me one day, what are you hiding? I said, I don't know. What do you mean, what am I hiding? See, that's how deep it is with you. That's how deep it is with you. You can't even get to it. I finally figured out that maybe he thought everybody was like him.
Right.
But I don't think you have to live with buried corruption. You can live real. The Pharisees lived, they were dead men's tombs painted white, as Jesus said. We don't want to be like them. We want to be able to let the real person out because that's the one that honors Christ. This series is going to be helpful to you based on Matthew 6, 1 to 8 and 16 to 18, stripping out the hypocrisy in our lives and being real. It's going to be a great time. Don't miss a day.
Yes, it is going to be a great time. And let's begin this study now. Stay here and learn how to spot spiritual hypocrisy and be sure you're living real. Here again is John MacArthur.
We're in the Sermon on the Mount, and the Sermon on the Mount is designed to present to the Jewish people of that time and to every succeeding generation who ever reads the Bible, the true standard of righteousness. Now, you remember that the Lord began with the character of righteousness in the Beatitudes, and then he moved to the influence of righteousness, salt and light in the world, and then he moved into the very elements of righteousness, the character of righteousness, its influence, and its standards. And the character of righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and the Pharisees. They didn't have that kind of character. They weren't mourning over their sin. They weren't meek. They weren't broken in spirit. They weren't hungering for righteousness. They weren't pure in heart. They weren't peacemakers. They weren't merciful. They weren't any of those things. And so he says, you don't meet the standard. And then he talks about the influence of righteousness. It's salt and light. It preserves and lightens the world. They didn't do that. They were part of the rot and part of the darkness. And then he says, now I want to tell you the standards of righteousness. And he started them in chapter 5, verse 21, and they didn't live up to any of them. They never met it. Their character was unqualified for his kingdom. Their influence was unqualified for his kingdom. And so was their standard of righteousness. And frankly, he's still talking about the same thing, the standards of righteousness here in chapter 6. But there's a little different twist that I want you to see. Because in chapter 5, verse 21 to 48, he was talking about the righteousness, now mark this word, taught by the scribes and Pharisees. The righteousness taught by the scribes and Pharisees. Now in chapter 6, he wants to see the righteousness practiced or lived by the scribes and Pharisees. One is their theology and the other is their living. In 5, he was saying, this is what you teach, but this is what God teaches. Now in 6, he says, this is how you worship. This is how you live. This is your practice. But God's standard is up here. So in one section, he is dealing with their teaching. In another, he is dealing with their practice. You might say that in one sense, in chapter 5, he's dealing with their morality, their theological content, their moral choices, their cognitive information, their standard of morality, and in the next one, with their religion. In other words, how that morality works out in their lives. Their worship was phony because their theology was phony. And true religion has to have both. You have to have the cognitive. You have to have the facts. You have to have the moral standards. You have to have the proper teaching. And then it has to be lived out in the proper way. And so here he is saying, when you're doing something, whether in verse 2, giving alms, or in verse 5, praying, or in verse 16, fasting. In other words, when you put your religion to practice, it is substandard. Your theology is inadequate, and so is your practice of religion. The morality of your system doesn't make it, and neither does the operation of your system. It's a very important thing to note this, people. As believers, we have to have both. There are always those people who think Christianity is only a matter of what you do. Just go to church, you know, and give a little in the offering, and do a religious ritual, and do your daily Bible reading or whatever, and you're all right. Well, that's not all there is. There's that cognitive, that responsibility to have a moral standard that is right. There are people today who just think all you need is the moral standard. They think all you got to do, they call it religionless Christianity. They don't want to identify with the church. They're anti-church. They're anti-structure, anti-organization. They just want to be pious in a vacuum. They want to be moral in a social way. But there's a balance. Jesus is saying, yes, you have to have proper teaching. But yes, there is a place for giving and praying and fasting within the community of those who believe, and that is to be exercised properly. It is a question of what you know and what you believe and also how you act. And the two have to be together. Now I want to show you another interesting thing. Jesus is setting a standard here that nobody else has ever set in the history of the world, except God, of course. No other human system ever came across this standard. It exceeds every system that has ever existed at the invention of man. I'll show you why. Go back into this section, chapter 5, verse 20. Now we're back into the moral section, what you teach, what you believe, your theology. I say unto you, verse 20, that except your righteousness exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you shall in no case enter the kingdom of heaven. Now, Jesus goes on then to present a moral standard that is in excess of the scribes and the Pharisees who were the teachers in Israel. All right? So it is superior to that system. There is a superior moral standard. Now go to chapter 6, verse 5. And he says, and when you pray, you shall not be as the hypocrites. All right, verse 2. When you do your alms, don't do it with a trumpet like the hypocrites. Verse 16, when you fast, don't be like the hypocrites. The hypocrites are synonymous with the Pharisees and the scribes. And again, he is saying, when you practice your religion, when you live out your spiritual life, it's got to be superior to theirs too. So what Jesus is saying, and I get this, is that what I'm saying to you in content is superior and in practice is superior to what's going on right now. This is an incredible indictment of the whole system. And there's even a third category. He goes from theology, the righteousness that relates to morality, to the righteousness that relates to practical religion, and then a third one, righteousness that relates to mundane things. And from verse 19 of chapter 6 on, he talks about things, mundane things like what you eat or what you drink or what you wear, clothing, and all of those kinds of things. He talks about money and how you treat it and how you think of it and how you regard it and so forth. So he really goes all the way down the line, doesn't he? He goes, now watch this, he goes from your theological moral values to your religious practices to your mundane everyday living. And in the whole sequence, he says, your theology is inadequate, your religion is inadequate, and your approach to life every day is inadequate. Your standards are totally too low. And that's why he says there in verse 19, you can't lay up for yourselves treasures on earth. You must not be anxious, verse 25, for your life. Why? Because that is characteristic of them. They were hung on laying up treasure on earth. They were anxious for their life. So he says it's got to be a system beyond that of the scribes and the Pharisees. Now, why am I emphasizing this? Because people, look, both our theology, our religion, our worship, if you will, and our daily living must be superior to the finest system men could ever devise at their very best efforts. It's inadequate. Further, there are some people who might say, well, I'd just as soon scratch all religion altogether and just be a pagan, just get a philosophy and go with it. Chapter 5, verse 47, he says this, if you greet your brethren only, what do ye more than others? Do not even the heathen? Be ye therefore perfect, as your Father who's in heaven is perfect. In other words, you're not only to have a commitment that is better than the scribes and the Pharisees, but it should also obviously be better than who? The heathen, right? They're substandard. He says the same thing in the next section in chapter 6. When he comes into the section of chapter 6, look at verse 7. Here he's talking about the religious life. But when you pray, use not vain repetition as the heathen. And in the third section, he does the same thing. When he gets to the mundane things in verse 32, for all these things do the heathen seek. In other words, Christ is saying, I'm offering you a standard. And the standard is superior in its content, in its worship, and in its daily living to any religious or non-religious system the world has ever seen. You see? Now, when somebody comes along and says, well, how come you Christians say you're the only ones that have the truth? You tell them. That's what Jesus said. Jesus, without question, is the most narrow-minded human who ever lived. He said, everything I say to you is true and anything else is false. Only he backed up the fact that he had a right to say it. Amen? You see, this is what he's saying here. You don't make it, people. You don't make it. You come miserably, woefully short of the standard for my kingdom. I'm a king. Matthew is saying that all the way through. And I'm offering a kingdom. But you're not going to get in it on the terms that you are now offering. There's another way. And that is to realize that you can't make it. Your theology is inadequate. Your religion is inadequate. And your approach to life is inadequate. You need somebody to wash away your sin, purify you, give you a new nature fit for my kingdom. And I'm that somebody is what Christ is saying. Now, that gives you the general context. We're looking at that middle section between theology and the mundane, that section of religious worship or practice. And he says, whatever you do in verse 1, make sure that you do your righteous acts. This has to do with your worship, your religious activity. Be sure you do it not to be seen by men. And he gives three illustrations. Three. The first one is giving in verses 2 to 4. The second is praying in verses 5 to 15. And the third is fasting in verses 16 to 18. The Lord just picks out three religious activities, three spiritual activities, three elements of worship. And they're very comprehensive. Giving has to do with our religion as it acts toward others. Praying has to do with our religion as it acts toward God. And fasting has to do with our religion as it relates to ourselves. Fasting deals with our own flesh, the mortification of the flesh, self-denial, discipline, bringing ourselves to Christ in terms of total commitment. Praying is then communing with God. Giving is then touching the lives of people around us. And so it really, these three illustrations beautifully sum up all the elements of our spiritual life, of our life of worship. It's almost as if they ascend, because you really start with a right spirit in your own heart, purging yourself, fasting being a part of self-denial. When you're right, then your prayers are going to be right. And out of fasting comes prayer, and out of prayer comes giving. And so he ascends from giving to praying to fasting. And says to them, in effect, you do all these. You give, you pray, you fast, but substandard. And I offer you something beyond that. By the way, it's interesting to notice, verse 2 says, when thou doest thine alms. Verse 5 says, when thou prayest. And verse 16 says, when ye fast. It doesn't say if, it says when. Why? Because it's an assumption that you'll do that. It's assumed as a part of religion. Worship, spiritual service. Now, I want you to see three key points in these first four verses. And we're just going to look at the first one, and we've already really done that. I just want to highlight a couple of things. I want you to see the practice of righteousness, the peril of religion, and the promise of reward. And we'll cover the two and three point next time. But the first one is the practice of religion, or the practice of righteousness. Look at verse 1 again. Beware that you do not your righteous acts before men to be seen by them. Now listen, beloved. The Bible talks about doing righteous acts. God never designed for us to be monks. Monasticism, stuffing yourself into oblivion and doing all your righteousness locked up in a cubicle, is not biblical. And some have misinterpreted this verse. Well, beware that you don't do any of your righteous acts before men, so go in a corner and do all your righteous acts. Now, wait a minute. Is that what the Bible means by what it says? Doesn't the Bible teach that we're to do righteous acts before men? Indeed, it does. In Psalm 106, verse 3, I'll just read it to you. It says this, blessed are they that observe justice, and he that doeth righteousness at all times. Blessed to do righteousness at all times. Isaiah 58, 2, you seek me daily and delight to know my ways as a nation that did righteousness. And 1 John 2:29 is another good word on this. It says, if you know that he is righteous, you know that everyone that doeth righteousness is born of him. In other words, we are to do righteousness, and we are to do it where it can be seen, so that people know we belong to God. We are to let our righteousness be manifest. And you say, well, wait a minute. It says right here, you don't do your righteousness before men. But you have to see the last phrase. It really in the Greek has the construction of purpose or design. For the purpose of, or to the design that we would be seen by men. In other words, you do your righteousness, but not for the purpose of simply being seen by men so that you look good. Let me show you the contrast. I think it's beautifully made in the very same passage. Look back at chapter 5, verse 16. What does it say? let your light so shine before men. There it is. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works. Now, wait a minute. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works. Chapter 6, verse 1. Beware that you do not your righteous acts before men to be seen by them. You see, those are mutually exclusive. Those are contradictory. No, because the motives are different. It says, do your works that God may be glorified. That's the positive in verse 16 of chapter 5. But don't do your works that men may glorify you. You see, it's really two sides of the same thing. In fact, there is no real issue here. It's only an imagined one. It's only semantics. It's only words, not a real problem. We are to do what we do that men may glorify God, but not for the purpose of seeking approval from them. And John Calvin says this is a necessary admonition, for in all virtues, the entrance of hypocrisy is to be avoided, and there is no work so laudable as not to be in many instances corrupted and polluted by hypocrisy. It's a fine line. I have that temptation in my own life. Our Lord had that temptation, I'm sure, because he was in all points tempted like as we are. But there are times when you are tempted to preach to be esteemed of men rather than to give God the glory. There are times when you give, and you give, and you make sure you tell certain people that you gave, especially people who question your commitment, so they'll know how really spiritual you are. Or you pray long and wordy prayers, or you fast or look sort of tragic, which is often confused with spirituality. Just look sick or painful, and people will think you're humble. You know, we're good at that. But we all play that game, and we're all tempted in that area. Augustine said that the love of honor was the deadly bane of true piety. He said, other vices bring forth evil works, but this brings forth good works in an evil way. I'd like to put it this way. Hypocrisy is the homage that vice pays to virtue. Hypocrisy. And our Lord is saying, beware. It was a mark of the Pharisees that when they gave, they blew a horn about it. And when they prayed, they stood in a public place and prayed out loud so everybody knew how spiritual they were. They're almost a caricature, so ridiculous it's hard to imagine. And when they fasted, they put cosmetics on their face so they'd look half dead, hoping someone would say, oh, what a holy man he is. Listen, we are to let our light shine. We are to let our works be seen, that God may be glorified, but we are not to do it that we may receive honor. That's hypocritical. In fact, 5:16 and 6:1 could best be summed up by indicating that they are both dealing with different sins. That's why I say the discrepancy is only imaginary, because the sins are different. In chapter 5, he's dealing with salt and light, and he's dealing with the fact that we need to be an influence in the world, and he's dealing then with the sin of cowardice. Let your light so shine before men. In other words, don't be a coward. You are the salt and you are the light. Let it happen. He's dealing with the sin of cowardice. But in chapter 6, verse 1, he's dealing with the sin of hypocrisy. I think A.B. Bruce brings the two together as simply as anyone I've read. He says, we are to show when tempted to hide, and we are to hide when tempted to show. The best way to be able to keep the tension is to play off your temptations in a righteous manner. The heart of the issue is the issue of the heart. What's your motive? Two people can give, two people can pray, two people can fast. Two people can do religious deeds. You and I would never know the difference between one or the other, and yet to God, one is a source of joy, a sweet-smelling savor, and the other is smoke in his nose. And the difference is inside that person. There's nothing wrong with displaying your Christianity. Let your light shine. Paul says they heard that I was converted, Galatians 1:23, and in verse 24 he says, and they glorified God because of me, but he didn't keep the glory, he passed it on to the Lord. In Romans 10 it says you have to confess with your mouth Jesus is Lord. It says, how shall people hear without a preacher? We are not rejecting public righteousness. We are not going to become monks and stash ourselves off in some kind of useless oblivion. Jesus said, whosoever shall confess me before what? Men, him will I confess before my Father who is in heaven. But whosoever shall deny me before men, him will I deny before my Father who is in heaven. We must practice our righteousness. We must, because we were created in the image of Christ unto good works. It's just that we have to be sure the motive is pure. Who is the best illustration of this? Jesus. Jesus preached his messages in the public hearing. Jesus lived his life day by day, the flawless, majestic sinlessness of his life in front of the gazing eyes of the whole watching world. Jesus performed miracles and wonders and signs so everyone could see. And in the midst of it all, in humility, he said, I have come not to seek mine own honor, but the honor of him who sent me. It was motive. Do your righteous deeds, beloved, if you're a believer. Do them that your light may shine to the glory of God. But beware when you do them to rearrange your ashes so somebody's picture of you will turn out to appear more holy than you really are.
You're listening to Grace to You with the verse-by-verse teaching of John MacArthur. He's president of the Masters University and Seminary, and today's lesson is part of a series that can teach you how always to live with integrity and to enjoy a life of genuine faith. It's titled Living Real. Keep in mind, you can purchase this entire series in a 5-CD album. You can also download all 5 messages free of charge from gty.org. To get John's study, Living Real, contact us today. The 5-CD album costs $24 and shipping is free. To order, call 800-55-GRACE or visit our website, gty.org. And again, you can download all 5 messages for free at gty.org. The title of the study, Living Real. Pick up a copy when you call 800-55-GRACE or visit gty.org. And if this verse-by-verse teaching is strengthening you spiritually, or if someone you know has come to faith in Christ after hearing this broadcast, we'd love to hear from you. Send us an email at letters@gty.org or mail your letter to Box 4000, Panorama City, California, 91412. And you can find all of our contact information at our website, gty.org. Now for John MacArthur, I'm Phil Johnson, reminding you to watch Grace to You Television Sundays on DirecTV Channel 378. And then be back here the same time tomorrow. John's lesson will help you answer a question all sincere believers ask. How can I give to the church and others without hypocrisy? Find out when John continues his series titled Living Real. Come back Thursday as we continue celebrating 50 years of unleashing God's truth one verse at a time on Grace to You.